everything in it is made possible by listeners like us. We are the Chu family from Stockton, California.
I'd like to congratulate my sister, Hannah, for graduating from our homeschool Morning Glory Academy. She's planning on getting an online communications degree from Liberty University this fall.
We hope you enjoy today's program.
Good morning. The federal government recommends states not lift stay-at-home orders until they had a two-week decline in new COVID-19 cases. But defining what a decline actually means has proven surprisingly difficult.
Yeah, that's ahead on Washington Wednesday. Also, World Tour. And we will remember apologist, author, and broadcaster Ravi Zacharias.
He's been an absolute inspiration, a hero of the faith, and he will definitely be in the Hall of Faith.
And Joel Bells on the importance of telling stories that bring glory to God.
It's Wednesday, May 20th. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Brian Basham.
And I'm Nick Eicher. Good morning.
Up next, Kent Covington has today's news.
President Trump said Tuesday that he's sending a letter to the World Health Organization with a clear ultimatum.
Basically, they have to clean up their act. They have to do a better job. They have to be much more fair to other countries, including the United States, or we're not going to be involved with them anymore. We'll do it a separate way.
The letter gives the WHO 30 days to make substantial changes, or the United States will permanently cut off funding. Washington sent nearly $500 million to the UN Health Agency last year. The White House froze funding last month pending an investigation. As the outbreak spread, the WHO largely deferred to China and heaped praise on Chinese leader Xi Jinping, even as many experts now say China was concealing the extent of the outbreak. Many other WHO member states share Trump's concerns, but say now is not the time to address them. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said the probe is warranted.
But let us for now focus on our most immediate challenge.
Member states met virtually Tuesday for day two of the organization's annual assembly. Many shared their concerns, including the agency caving to Chinese pressure to exclude Taiwan from the WHO. But members ultimately approved a resolution that backs cooperation to find tools to address COVID-19. The White House is pushing back against criticism after President Trump's announcement Monday that he's been taking hydroxychloroquine. That's an anti-malaria drug that some health experts believe could help with the coronavirus. He said he's been taking it as a preventative measure.
I think it gives you an additional level of safety, but you can ask many doctors are in favor of it. Many frontline workers won't go there unless they have the hydroxy. And so, again, this is an individual decision to make.
The FDA warned health professionals last month that the drug should not be used to treat COVID-19 outside of hospital or research settings. It has the potential to cause significant side effects in some patients, and studies of its effectiveness against COVID-19 have produced mixed results. And critics say Trump's example could lead many to misuse the drug. But the White House noted that the drug is only available by prescription and has been widely used for other purposes for decades. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin and Fed Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell testified Tuesday about what it will take to pull the U.S. economy out of its coronavirus nosedive. Both men spoke to members of the Senate Banking Committee. Mnuchin stressed the urgency of getting American businesses back up and running, and he said he believes that can and is being done responsibly.
I couldn't be more proud of the medical advice that we're getting and the way the economy is opening up in a safe way.
But he warned that prolonged business shutdowns would pose long-term threats to the economy, adding, quote, there is risk of permanent damage. Powell said the Fed's lending programs for medium-sized businesses and state and local governments will launch very soon.
We expect all of them to be stood up and ready to go by the end of this month. I don't say that it won't be a day or two into June, but that's our expectation, and the funds should be flowing directly after that.
While the Fed can loan money, only Congress can approve stimulus payments and forgivable loans like those in the Paycheck Protection Program. And Powell once again stressed the need for Congress to consider approving more financial aid soon to avoid a deeper recession. The Oregon Supreme Court has halted a judge's ruling which had tossed out the governor's coronavirus lockdown orders. World Radio's Anna Johansson has more.
Baker County Circuit Judge Matthew Shurtcliffe ruled on Monday that Governor Kate Brown overstepped her authority by extending stay-at-home orders past a 28-day limit. The judge said the governor needed the approval of the legislature to extend the orders. But hours later, the state Supreme Court stayed that ruling, pending review by all the high court justices. In a statement, Brown praised the court's action. Her words, "There are no shortcuts for us to return to life as it was before this pandemic. Moving too quickly could return Oregon to the early days of this crisis when we braced ourselves for hospitals to be overfilled." The lower court judge had issued his opinion in response to a lawsuit filed earlier this month by 10 churches arguing the directives were unconstitutional. Reporting for World, I'm Anna Johansson.
Walt Disney World is preparing to let some third-party shops and restaurants reopen at its entertainment complex, Disney Springs, this week with new safety measures. All workers and visitors over the age of 2 will be required to wear face masks. Everyone will get temperature checks, and the number of guests will be limited. They're also installing extra hand sanitizer and hand-washing stations. Last week, Universal Orlando allowed a half-dozen restaurants and 2 retail shops to reopen at its CityWalk entertainment complex. Neither Disney World nor Universal officials have said when they plan to reopen their theme parks or hotels. I'm Kent Covington, and straight ahead, redefining the guidelines states use to reopen, plus Joel Bell's on the spheres of World's mission. This is The World and Everything in It.
It's Wednesday, the 20th of May, 2020. Glad to have you along for today's edition of The World and Everything in It. Good morning. I'm Nick Eicher.
And I'm Brian Basham. First up, recommendations for reopening.
Back in mid-April, the White House Coronavirus Task Force recommended that states have a 14-day decline in COVID-19 cases before they ease stay-at-home restrictions. Few have actually met that benchmark, but by Memorial Day, and that's less than a week from now, every state will have started lifting limits on businesses and public gatherings.
With tens of millions predictably unemployed, the pressure to get people back to work is driving the push to reopen. Some governors say they know they're taking a risk, but one they say is both calculated and necessary. There has been some confusion about how to define a 14-day decline, though. Suppose there's an isolated outbreak at a nursing home. Does that mean states need to reset their count? And how should officials factor in increasing test capacity, which leads, of course, to more positive cases?
Scott Gann is a research fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He's also an assistant professor of public policy at the Georgia Institute of Technology. He ran the numbers and made his own recommendation for how states ought to interpret the data. He joins us now to talk about it via Skype from Washington. Good morning, Professor.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Well, so the number 14 has a rational basis, but calculating what qualifies as 14, well, that's not quite so easy, and that's what you've done a lot of work on. So explain why it's so complicated.
So I think that when the White House Coronavirus Task Force came out with this idea that we should be looking for 14 days of reductions in cases, people thought, oh, that seems pretty intuitive. If, you know, we look at a line, and if that line goes down for 14 days, then we're all good. But then you realize when you're actually looking at a line in real time and asking, is that line really actually going down for 2 straight weeks? It's not as easy as that. So for example, if there's just some normal randomness in the data, right, we might see a little blip upwards in the middle of a week. And then you need to ask yourself, well, do we now not have 14 days of declining cases? Or if you want to think about it sort of in a different way, imagine all we're looking at is the data today less than the number was 14 days ago? We face the same problems where if just it happened to be the case that 14 days ago, the data was a little bit higher or a little bit lower, you're going to get really different answers. Luckily, thinking about this from the perspective of statistics, we're pretty comfortable taking into account that kind of random variability in data. And that's what I was trying to do.
Well, how do you propose, and I mean, look, I looked at your paper and it reminded me of some economic textbooks back in the day, but we are trying to explain this as simply as possible. So without going into the full equation, give it to me as a thumbnail rule.
So the way that I think about it, and I think this is consistent with the way that others who are looking at the data are talking about what we mean when we're talking about 14 days of consistent decline, is the data that we're looking at should be well modeled, sort of roughly approximated by a downward sloping, what I'm going to call a stair step function, which I call in the paper a monotonically decreasing function. What that means is we should be able to draw a line through the data where that line, as time goes along, it moves down. It doesn't need to move down at a constant rate. It can be going down at a slow rate or a fast rate. It can be going down slow in the beginning and then a little bit faster and then a little bit slower. But sort of over the course of the 14 days, we want that line trending downward. And for me, I think that's what I look for in the data. And that's actually what I think that most people look for when they think about what are we talking about when we mean 14 days of consistent decline.
Well, now the model that you created, you applied that to some of the data publicly available. Could you just talk briefly about what you found and how states are applying the data we have?
Yeah, for sure. I applied this criterion, what I'm going to call a monotonically decreasing criterion, to eight different states. And I chose those eight states just purely because I thought the data was good for those states. You could apply it to more states if you wanted to. And I asked the question, do positive test rates, so think about that as the ratio of the total number of positive cases divided by the total number of positive tests, does that have this consistent decline, right? Is it well characterized by a downward sloping stair step function? And the answer I found was that in New York, it appeared to be the case. And in the other seven states that I analyzed, the data didn't seem to say that. The data was sort of better characterized by a different shape.
Well, now, as I mentioned, more or less every state is going to be opening or at least beginning to reopen by Memorial Day on Monday. So are you saying that there are some states that are acting rashly here? And maybe the better question is, how does this guide policymakers?
I would say to start, right, I'm more concerned actually with the state of the data. So if we think about all of the different variables or the different sort of indicators that we might want to look at when it comes to deciding when should I reopen my state, right? There sort of, we could think about how many cases are there. We could think about what is the overall rate of infection in the population. We could think about conditional on getting infected, what is the probability of having a serious negative reaction or even dying? And between different states, but also sort of on the nation as a whole, I just don't think we have a really good grasp of what those numbers are saying. And so as a result, we're sort of asking policymakers to make a decision with their gut when we would hope that instead they would be able to make decisions based on objective analysis.
Yeah, and speaking of which, I mean, isn't it a bit arbitrary even to draw the line at state lines? Isn't it better really county by county, city by city? Because, I mean, you know, outstate Missouri is not the same as St. Louis, Missouri, for example.
That's absolutely right. Right. So the way that the policy response has been organized in the U.S. is on a state-by-state level. And so as a result, you're seeing some states treating some counties different than others. So in Virginia, for example, they're opening up the areas of Virginia outside of the sort of D.C. suburbs earlier than the areas in the D.C. suburbs, precisely because those two regions are very, very different in terms of both the intensity to which they've been affected by COVID-19, but also in terms of sort of simple things like the density of the population. But nevertheless, the question of whether the state is sort of the right unit to be managing the response is a really good one. And one that my understanding is the U.S. is quite unique in terms of managing the crisis sort of in this individual way.
Yeah, and that kind of vindicates the design of federalism, doesn't it? We're just sort of saying we're not going to have a top-down solution from Washington. Local policymakers need to do the best they can because there is a lot of going on gut instincts here.
So that's definitely the approach that we're taking, right? And it has some benefits and it has some costs, right? One of the benefits is that you do at least have the opportunity to have solutions which are tailored to the local environment. But there are huge costs, right? If we think about the fact that people, for example, can easily travel across state lines, that means that we have a public health response that's being managed on a state level, but the pandemic is, you know, global, but definitely national.
Scott Ganz is a research fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. He's also assistant professor of public policy at the Georgia Institute of Technology. Thank you, Scott, for joining us today.
Hey, this was great. Thanks so much for having me.
Additional support comes from Maranatha Baptist University. Flexible, biblical, engaging online options from high school to graduate school, mbu.edu. And from Covenant Theological Seminary, offering a new church planting track designed by church planters. More at covenantseminary.edu/plant.
Coming up next on The World and Everything in It, World Tour. We had some technical trouble connecting with Africa reporter Onize Ohikere today, so we'll be taking you on today's tour of international news.
And we will begin today in the Middle East, where five Iranian oil tankers are on their way to Venezuela, the ships likely carrying at least $45 million worth of gasoline products. Iran is under heavy sanctions from the United States, and the tankers are away to bring money in around those sanctions. Venezuela is also under U.S. sanctions and starved for usable energy. The socialist country has little to lose by accepting those shipments from Iran. But the strategy could also trigger renewed conflict between Iran and the United States. On Thursday, Washington issued an advisory notice to the maritime industry. It said to watch out for illegal shipping and tactics used to dodge sanctions. Iran's foreign ministry replied that if the United States does not like this trade, that is their problem. The spokesman warned Iran will retaliate if the United States intervenes and called any potential U.S. action piracy.
Next, we go to Europe.
This is Kabunga Felicien.
One of the last key leaders of the Rwandan genocide was arrested in France on Saturday. Felicien Kabunga was living under a false identity in a Paris suburb. The 84-year-old used to be one of Rwanda's richest men. He's accused of bankrolling the extremists who killed 800,000 people in 1994. Kabunga also imported hundreds of thousands of machetes and helped create a radio station that encouraged the slaughter. In 1997, he was indicted for genocide and crimes against humanity. Kabunga will stand trial before a UN criminal tribunal. Officials said his arrest is a reminder that those responsible for genocide can be brought to account even 26 years after their crimes.
Next, on to Albania, where hundreds of protesters gathered in the nation's capital Sunday to protest the demolition of a historical theater. They waved red and black Albanian flags and chanted, "Down with the dictatorship." The National Theater was built by Italians when they occupied Albania during World War II. In 2018, the government decided to demolish the theater and build a new one. That sparked heated political debates between the ruling party and the opposition. Heavy machinery toppled the building early Sunday morning, but the protests continued. Albania's prime minister said the protests amounted to hysteria. He said the people who oppose the plan for the new theater don't love development.
And finally, we end today in Italy. Gondolas are back on the canals of Venice. After months of coronavirus shutdowns, Italy took another step toward reopening on Monday. Most businesses are now open, and gondoliers are once again transporting passengers. The boatmen wear masks and gloves, and the gondolas are marked with tape to keep passengers 6 feet apart. There aren't many customers yet, but the gondoliers hope that will change soon. Italy plans to open its borders to European tourists on June 3rd. And that's this week's World Tour.
Well, most art lovers will never lay eyes on a Picasso without standing behind a velvet rope. But Christie's Auction House in Paris is giving the average Joe a chance to hang an original Picasso in his living room. Rather than auctioning the artwork to wealthy art aficionados, Christie's has been selling raffle tickets at a little more than $100 a piece. The painting is a 1921 oil on canvas valued at more than $1 million. One art lover acknowledged the long statistical odds of winning. She is nevertheless excited for the opportunity.
Everywhere where you go in the world, you go to the Far East, to the West Coast, anywhere you go, everyone knows who is Picasso. Even if you don't know the work of Picasso into details, you know who is Picasso. You've heard about Picasso.
Raffle organizers say they've raised about $5.5 million. The money will go to charity to provide access to clean water to communities in Africa. Christie's will draw a winner today. It's the world and everything in it.
Today is Wednesday, May 20th. Thank you for turning to World Radio to help start your day. Good morning. I'm Brian Basham.
And I'm Nick Eicher. Coming next on The World and Everything in It, remembering Ravi Zacharias.
May I please close in prayer? One day we will stand before you, and Lord, I have absolutely no doubt we'll be silent. Because everything about you will transcend anything we could say.
That is Zacharias speaking at the Passion Conference in Atlanta earlier this year. The well-known Christian apologist, author, and broadcaster died Tuesday morning at his home in Atlanta. He was 74 years old.
His family announced earlier this month that Zacharias would be suspending treatment of the cancer that was first discovered in March. News of his imminent death brought tributes from all over the globe. World correspondent Katie Galtney has this remembrance.
Well-wishers included Christian musician Matt Redman and Sheikh Nayan bin Mubarak al-Nayan, the Minister of Tolerance for the United Arab Emirates, among many others. Well-known Christian athlete Tim Tebow reflected on Zacharias' impact in an emotional video posted to Twitter.
He's been an absolute inspiration, a hero of the faith, and he will definitely be in the Hall of Faith. And
Zacharias was born in Chennai in southeastern India, but around age 4, he moved with his family to Delhi, where he grew up. He was often physically and verbally abused. That led him to develop a sense of worthlessness. His parents considered their family Christian, but Zacharias said he was without any spiritual instruction. The only evidence of Christianity in his home was the food that they ate and the holidays they celebrated. When he was a teenager, he attended a local Youth for Christ, or YFC, rally with his siblings. The promise of refreshments lured him to the meeting, but when Sam Wolgamuth of YFC gave the altar call, Zacharias was the only person who responded. Drawn by Wolgamuth's gentle demeanor, Zacharias recalled desiring a change in his life.
So here I was as a young teen, just finding a hero and saying, whatever it is he has, I want to have.
But a few months after responding to that calling, Zacharias found himself spiraling under his father's scrutiny. He attempted suicide by poison at age 17. A YFC minister named Fred David visited him in the hospital and gave him a Bible. After hearing John 14:19, where Jesus said, "Because I live, you also will live," Zacharias committed his life to Christ.
I just cried out. It was a prayer of desperation. I said, "Jesus, if you're who you claim to be, take me out of here. I will leave no stone unturned in my pursuit of truth."
He said he walked out of the hospital 5 days later a changed man. He began sharing the gospel publicly at age 19, even winning a preaching contest. A year later, the family moved to Canada. Instead of going into business, as his father had hoped, he earned theological degrees from Ontario Bible College, now Tyndale University College and Seminary, and Trinity International University. After graduating, Zacharias joined the Christian and Missionary Alliance. That allowed him to travel the world preaching. In South Vietnam, Cambodia, Europe, and India, he was struck by the lack of Christian apologetics ministries. That void led him to begin Ravi Zacharias International Ministries, or RZIM, in 1984. It was his calling.
A job is something you choose. A calling is something for which you are chosen. God has placed you where he has placed you by design.
Today, RZIM includes about 75 Christian apologists who defend the faith and train Christian leaders around the world. Zacharias' Let My People Think broadcast aired on more than 2,000 stations in 32 countries. He was also a prolific author. His 28 books have sold millions of copies worldwide and been translated into over a dozen languages. Zacharias was at his best when answering skeptics and atheists at forums he hosted around the world. He used his vast knowledge of world philosophies and religions to keenly break down why Christianity is the only faith that stands up to intellectual scrutiny.
I think Christianity, when the tests of truth are put, is the only system that coherently brings the answers to the four fundamental questions of life: origin, meaning, morality, and destiny, and correspondingly in each case will measure up to the truth.
Like many prominent Christian leaders, though, Zacharias was not immune to controversy. He faced criticism for occasionally going by Dr. Zacharias because his many doctorates were honorary. He was also caught up in a scandal that involved inappropriate texts sent by a Canadian woman he met at a conference. Zacharias said the explicit photos she sent him were unsolicited and unwelcome. He even filed a lawsuit against the woman and her husband since they attempted to extort Zacharias over the photos. He apologized publicly for not drawing stricter boundaries that would have protected him from the appearance of impropriety. But Zacharias will be remembered for his many decades of ministry and discipleship. One notable RZIM speaker and Zacharias acolyte was Nabil Qureshi, a convert from Islam, whose book Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus became a New York Times bestseller. Qureshi died in 2017 of stomach cancer. Speaking at Qureshi's funeral, Zacharias reflected on having a heavenly perspective.
For the first time in his life, he is seeing reality the way God wanted him to see it. He looked through a keyhole all along, now he's seeing the whole panorama.
He concluded his remarks by reciting lyrics from a favorite hymn, The Lost Chord.
It may be that death's bright angel will speak in that chord again. It may be that only in heaven I shall hear that great amen.
His wife of 48 years, Margie, three children, and several grandchildren survive him. Today, the many believers who have grown through the work and ministry of Ravi Zacharias grieve with hope and cling to the certainty that Ravi has now heard that great amen. Reporting for World Radio, I'm Katie Galtney.
Wednesday, May 20th. Good morning. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Nick Iger.
And I'm Brian Basham. Up next, World founder Joel Bells muses about a question you may have wondered yourself.
When you pick up your latest issue of World, do you think of it more as a business enterprise or as a ministry? Do you think first of Truett Cathy or of Billy Graham? From my point of view as founder of World, I hope you think of us in both categories. World is part ministry because it helps you develop your biblical understanding of all that is going on from a God-centered perspective. But World is also part business because you expect to get your money's worth with your annual membership and because you expect us to conduct our affairs in an orderly manner. That blend always carries with it a certain tension. On one side, we have a healthy desire to see God's kingdom expanded. On the other, we take clear note of the tools we employ to bring that expansion about. So it's right, isn't it, to hope for and to plan on growth in the circulation of World's paper and ink edition, and for more subscribers to our podcasts. We all want to see the fruit of our work extended, but at what cost? What if we discover we could increase our monthly downloads from the current 1 million to 5 million, but that it would cost $1 million to do it? Is that a business decision or a ministry decision? If at this point my reasoning strikes you as a bit muddled, you're catching on. I freely confess to spending too many years uncertain whether I was engaged in ministry or business. I vividly remember some 25 years ago, boldly approaching a highly competent businessman who was already a generous donor. I asked him for a gift of $1 million, which would go entirely to build the print circulation of World. I stressed how this would at the same time extend the ministry of World. "Joel," he replied in kind but straightforward tone, "you know I have $1 million. You know that I may well give it to World someday, but not now. If I gave it to you now, a year from now, neither one of us would know where it had gone." My friend was way ahead of me. He knew the limitations of my mind when it came to business theory, business analysis, business practice. He helped me learn a few of those things before I handed the leadership of World and its parent organization to others. Over the last decade, CEO Kevin Martin has displayed great gifts while thoughtfully leading our World News Group team in the work of blending ministry and business in everything we do. I encourage you to apply the same kind of thinking to all the charitable organizations you support. Do they thoughtfully blend ministry and business? And don't worry if World doesn't easily fit into just one of those categories. I hope we continue to wear both hats and to wear them well. I'm Joel Bells.
Tomorrow, voting in person may be too risky this fall. We'll tell you how some states are preparing for an increase in mail-in ballots. And as churches begin meeting together again, worship leaders are facing a tough decision about congregational singing. That and more tomorrow. I'm Nick Iger.
And I'm Brian Basham. The world and everything in it comes to you from World Radio. World's mission is biblically objective journalism that informs, educates, and inspires. The Apostle Paul reminds us, be kind to one another, tender-hearted, forgiving one another, just as God in Christ forgave you. Well, I hope you all catch this morning's World Watch News in 3 at worldwatch.news. Have a great rest of the day, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.